Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're taking the rest of the week off, so we're bringing you some of our favorite shows from the archives. Today, Brian Terry. He's the kind of chef who sees food not only as sustenance, but as a way of probing and challenging the world. Known for his distinctive work reconceptualizing soul food into vegan fare, his cooking practice now extends to a 6-year run as chef-in-residence at the Museum of African Diaspora. But his new project, a book called Black Food, that he conceived and edited, might be his most ambitious project yet. This is not your standard cookbook, and that is a good thing. We'll be back with my interview with Brian Terry after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. In the introduction of Brian Terry's new book, Black Food, Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora, Terry presents the work of the dozens of people who contributed as a kind of altar, honoring the experiences and traditions of the African diaspora, while urging us to stop and dive deeply into the politics of pleasure, of rest. Terry writes that black food represents a bridge from our ties to traditions in the motherland to our wildest dreams that will manifest in the future. And he's begun to realize one of his dreams, publishing more writers of color through a new imprint of 10-speed press called 4Color. Black Food is the first book to appear from the new imprint, and it's even accompanied by one of Terry's signature musical playlists, which we'll be hearing cuts from throughout the show. So thank you for the music, and welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure to chop it up with you, Alexis.
Yeah, it's good to talk with you. I want you to talk about the vision for this book. For those who haven't seen it, it's extremely beautiful. This is really unlike your other cookbooks, though.
Sure. Well, I think one of the biggest digressions or departures from my body of work is that this is actually, it isn't plant-based. Most people know me as a vegan chef and a vegan cookbook author. And it was an interesting process because I really had to take off my hat of being an author and put on my hat as an editor and a publisher. Mm-hmm. And I knew that allowing people to tell the most authentic story of their connection with Black food was the best decision for this book project. And so I encourage people to offer a plant-based dish because I think we need more delicious and interesting plant-based dish from some of the finest chefs in the world. And I didn't want to be overly prescriptive. And I'm happy that the majority of the recipes are actually vegetarian and vegan. And, you know, there's a little something for everyone in here. And in terms of the vision, you know, I just wanted to, this is a love letter to Black people. You know, I don't know if I know, you know, Alexis, about the 90s hip hop clothing brand FUBU, For Us, yeah. By Us, by Damon John. And when I was reaching out to all the contributors, that's what I was very clear about. I said, you know, I really want us to approach this book without concern for the white gaze, without concern for explaining or translating. This is us talking to each other, and we're inviting the world to listen in and be a part of the conversation.
Well, and I was, you know, looking at some of the noted inspirations that you had for this book, like Toni Morrison's The Black Book and other kinds of like compendiums, right? Because this isn't, you know, if people are thinking about a traditional recipe book, you know, where they'd be like, oh, appetizers, entrees, it's not really built like that, right? So give me a couple of those, like, you know, touch points for you, what you were kind of grounding yourself in previous publishing experiments.
Sure. Well, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about one of the biggest inspirations for Black food is my residency at the Museum of the African Diaspora. And in 2015, our former executive director, Linda Harrison, approached me because she really saw the importance of including programming in our powerful Small but Mighty Museum in San Francisco. And just to be clear, you know, this museum just plays such a vital role in a city that's had such a rapidly dwindling population of Black people over the past couple of decades, and just holding space, creating community. And because of many of the issues that intersect in terms of like the exponential rise in preventable diet-related illnesses among African-American communities, the kind of environmental racism, all these issues that I think we can use food as a kind of jumping point to talk about. These are conversations that are vital to San Francisco. And so having this program that allowed me to create, you know.
Yeah, what did you do? What does a chef in residence do at a museum?
Yeah, great question. You know, I'd like to say we pioneered this program, and we continue to get messages every week from different institutions around the globe. Maybe they're not interested in wholesale creating a chef in residence program, but more people are seeing the importance of talking about health, food, and farming issues. And so everything from panel discussions, and I was very intentional about the first program we did, which is a panel discussion called Black Women, Food and Power, because I wanted to kick off my residency recognizing the historical and the contemporary role of Black women in the production, distribution, and consumption of food and food knowledge, because we had a number of scholars on there. So yeah, we had Psyche Williams Foursome, who's one of the foremost scholars of food, specifically African-American food ways in the country. Gail Myers, who's a farmer, a poet, and a scholar. Nicole Taylor, a brilliant activist and journalists in the South. Carolyn Randall Williams, I think you guys were at Harvard at the same time, brilliant poet and TV host. So we talked about these issues. And let me tell you, Alexis, I knew that this program was, like, there was a hunger for this program, pun intended, when I saw that, you know, I expected that there'd be people driving up from Los Angeles. And, you know, it wasn't surprising that people were coming from Pacific Northwest. But when I saw that people were flying from the East Coast, New Jersey, New York, Philadelphia,
you flew from Atlanta to here for this
program, right? And so I knew that this was something that was groundbreaking and important for Black people around the diaspora, throughout the diaspora, not just in the U.S. And so I had always thought about creating a book project that really shared with the world this magical, brilliant, thought-provoking programming that we're doing at our museum. And 2020, you know, we can talk about the series of events that really were the catalyst.
Why not? Let's not. Yeah.
No, and it was just, you know, on the heels of a lot of the uprisings and revelations of racism within food media, I felt like, you know, this was the time. No more, you know, I put all these unnecessary barriers in front of this book, the imprint, and I was like, no, this is the moment. This is a historical and movement moment, and I want this to be my contribution.
And it is a pretty amazing document. Like, you really feel like people will look back at this book and say, like, wait, this was really trying to do something. And one of the things that really struck me is, had you kind of taken this diasporic turn before you started doing the chef in residency gig? Or was that what really led you to what's really like an amazing and interesting and very specific array of African stories that are in this book?
I've been thinking about the diaspora in just, you know, so many complicated ways since I was in a PhD program at NYU in history. And I had an emphasis on the African diaspora, studying under my advisor, Robin D.G. Kelly. And when I moved into food and went to culinary school and was thinking about food, you can't talk about African-American cuisine without looking at it through a diasporic lens, right? Mm-hmm. You think about the food that traveled from West and Central Africa to the New World and how that intermingled with the indigenous foods and flavors and cooking techniques of this land, and then the influence of European cuisine and cooking techniques and flavors and staples. And so I've always said that, you know, in my mind, African-American cuisine is the original modern global fusion cuisine. And so, you know, if you look at my body of work, I've done what I did in Black Food in all of my books. You know, I've always had the suggested soundtrack, as you mentioned. I've always kind of looked at food, you know, even thinking about African-American food, kind of looking at it through the more diasporic lens. This is the first time I've had a lot of money to really do it so well as I've been done in Black Food. But, you know, one of the feelings, just going back to one of the major inspirations, Alexis, Toni Morrison, there are a couple things. One, I want to say that her Black Book, it just floored me. When I remember being an undergrad and just stumbling upon it in the library and finding this kind of compendium, this survey of African-American life and culture and history from like the 1600s into the 1960s. And the way that she combined not just text, but, you know, song lyrics and archival photos and ephemera, like the feeling it had, it just moved me, not on just an intellectual kind of cerebrally, but it moved me in a very like viscerally and spiritual way as well. And I wanted this book project to do that. I want people to pick up this book and just to feel just moved to be better people, moved to learn more about our history and culture, moved to make food, to build community around the table. And, you know, just kind of, you know, finishing on Toni Morrison's inspiration, when I emailed the more than 100 potential contributors to the book project, the thing that I invited them to do is to consider Toni Morrison's quote, where she invites us to consider what our lives look like without racism. What does, you know, what does Black life look like without the albatross of white supremacy around our necks? And how can, you know, that energy come to this book? And so I ask people, you know, what is our magic? What is our brilliance? What is our agency? You know, that's what I want this book to be about. And not really kind of like revisiting many of the atrocities and ways in which we've been erased and marginalized, because we can't talk about the history without acknowledging that, but I wanted this to be about more than that.
So tell me how the book is organized. Like, give me a few of these sections so that people can kind of get a sense of how that brilliance sort of translated onto the page.
Sure. Well, I mean, literally, Alexis, the thing is, many of the chapters, and this is just how deeply the book is inspired by my residency, many of the chapters are literally pulled from the title of the program that I did at the museum. So Black Women, Food and Power, Land Liberation and Food Justice, Black Queer Food, these are all programs that I did at MOAD, where I invited these brilliant people working in you know, the food space to come and just dig deeply into these issues. And so, you know, in terms of the structure, you know, I really think it's so important for me to start with just spirit, you know, just start with, I don't know, however people want to think about it, infinite intelligence, the primal sound, just like that quiet moment that I think we all experience, and which is so central to African-American culture, just like acknowledging the land, acknowledging community, acknowledging the ancestors, and all the elements that, you know, help get the food to our plate, from the natural elements to the animals, to the, you know, the people who transported and made the food. And I was so blessed to have Reverend Marvin White offer those words to open up the book, because when I have in-person events in the Bay Area, I'm calling up Marvin White and I'm like, listen, brother, I need you
Minister
to start
Marvin
off with a prayer, with something just to like set the energy and really bring people into the experience that we're having. And so, you know, from there, I just was really just kind of thinking about just whatever the kind of arc of movement that I imagine in my mind, starting with, you know, just life on the continent. And, you know, it was important for me to really capture life on the continent without just the lens of just kind of like suffering and poverty.
Yeah. But, you know, and we're going to talk about more about that when we come back from the break. We're talking with Brian Terry, chef and food justice activist. He's editor and curator of the new cookbook, Black Food. And we're going to go into this break hearing a bit of Alice Coltrane's Blue Nile. It's part of the Motherland section of Black Food, the new cookbook by Terry. We'll be back with more. I'm Alexis Madrigal.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Chef Brian Terry about Black Food, a new cookbook he edited and curated celebrating food, art, and stories of the African diaspora. You just heard a bit of Guy Warren's Talking Drums, a song from the book Spirit section playlist. And we're going to get into the spirit of this book a bit more with Brian and also with one of the book's contributors, Reverend Marvin K. White, who joins us now. Welcome to Forum, Minister Marvin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Minister Marvin is a poet, preacher, writer, and artist who is the Minister of Celebration at Glide Memorial Church. I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of your piece titled From Scratch in just a moment. But first, how did you get involved with the book and what inspired your piece?
Yeah, so any time that Bryant calls on me for anything, I respond. And, you know, particularly when we're talking about the diaspora and Blackness and food ways and culture, that there is a space made for spirituality, which cannot be extracted from Black food ways. I just thought it was an amazing assignment and a real way to talk about the diaspora and the ways that we have to stop and bless, you know, our meals and show gratitude, not for the, you know, for capitalism and not for the ways in which we are, you know, deemed worthy to eat, but because we are a part of this natural system and we're grateful to be there. So I'm really, anytime I can bring, you know, Blackness and spirituality and culture together, I'm there. And so this book represented a chance to do that.
Let's hear you read a little bit from Scratch.
On the first day, God made a meal plan. Finally had it all figured out, finally had a taste for something. On the second day, God made a grocery list, one of everything God thought. On the third day, God planted a garden, God's own farmer's market. On the fourth day, God sharpened God's knives, God created iron and cast it into skillets. God preheated the oven and forgot about it. We will talk about this hell another time. On the fifth day, God chopped and God baked and God boiled and God braised and God broiled and God fried and God grilled and God roasted and God poached and God steamed and God stewed. For hours, God stewed. On the sixth day, God opened all the pots and a mist went up from the pots and watered the whole face of God. And God sweat the vegetables. On the seventh day, God created company and they came over and they ate with God. And God looked around at God's kitchen and ended their work, which they had done, and they rested. On the eighth day, itis. This is the story and the history of cooking by sight and by smell. This is the history of creation of the heavens and the earth and soul food. Before any Tupperware, before any tinfoil, before anybody said how they would have made it, God created satisfaction.
That was Minister Marvin, poet, preacher, writer, and artist. He's the Minister of Celebration at Glide Memorial Church. And that was an opening prayer poem from Scratch, from the new book edited by Brian Terry, chef and food justice activist. He's also the chef in residence at San Francisco's Museum of the African Diaspora and a winner of the James Beard Award for Culinary Excellence. We want to hear from you, too. What are your questions for Chef Brian Terry? Do you have a favorite recipe of his that you'd like to shout out? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook, of course. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. You know, Brian, I want to ask you a little bit about the role of ritual in this book. Can you talk about kind of the role that you tried to set up for it? Like, you know, someone's opening a book, that's kind of its own ritual. And then there's all these sort of almost like prayers and pathways that you could have your own rituals with this book.
Sure. You know, I think it's important when people think about the title of this book, Black Food, that they think about food and its many definitions. We're obviously talking about literal sustenance and the recipes that I hope people will make and gather around the table with. But I also wanted to feed people intellectually with the riveting essays. I wanted to move people spiritually with the poems and the powerful artwork that we included. And I really wanted to provide people with tools because, so Alexis, you got to remember, this is a pandemic book. This is my pandemic baby right here. We put this book together in 9 months over the pandemic. And boy, was that an arduous task, but we did it. And within that, people were going through a lot. You know, many of our team members had, you know, just life was happening. People were in their families were getting ill. Some people passed away, including people in my family. People were overworked, overstressed, trying to just figure out this new historic moment and how to kind of thrive. And I mean, at the most, but at least exist and you know, just kind of like stay afloat. And, you know, I thought it was important that we tapped on many of the brilliant people who were really encouraging us to think about the role of self-care and rest in this moment. Trisha Hersey, aka the Nat Minister, you know, her work has been, you know, so widely celebrated over the past 2 years because people recognize that capitalism is just running us ragged. And even trying to maintain the same pace that we typically do, you know, during the pandemic and shelter in place, it's just wearing people out. And so everything from, you know, the okra bath that Crystal Mack, chef and creative in Baltimore, offered, to just rituals around connecting with nature and, you know, plant medicine. I really wanted to provide people with all the tools that will inspire them to think about self-care and not just a kind of capitalist, you know, consumer-driven self-care where you got to go and spend a lot of money at a spa and you got to go and, you know, get some expensive mask or aromatherapy or whatever, but really thinking about like self-care in a more expansive way. Like, what does self-care mean? Self-care means healing generational trauma. Self-care means, you know, a lot more than just going buying something that's going to make us feel good temporarily. And so I'm glad that I feel like in terms of the response from the people since the book was published 2 weeks ago, that has been one of the sections that people have been, you know, responding to the most. I get a lot of messages about how they found a lot of tools to take care of themselves in this moment in the book. And that makes me really happy.
Mr. Marvin, what do you think ritual does for people? Like, you know, you honor the food, but what does it do for people themselves when they take that second to recognize that those natural and other systems that went into putting that on their plate?
Yeah, I think it just reminds us that, you know, that Black folks are the original mindfulness community.
Ooh.
You know, that, you know, yes. We stop and pause. You know, enslaved or incarcerated, you know, we remove ourselves from systems and we stop and we meditate and then we proceed at our own pace. You know, I definitely believe that Black folks are inherently theorists and theologians, you know, and we participate in creation by the ways in which we prepare and name our dishes. You know, so you go from, you know, naming food, to making dishes out of the food you name, to making meals out of the dishes, making holidays out of the meals.
Making TikToks out of the meals.
Yes, 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 yes. And it just keeps unfolding. But, you know, we imagine, you know, and I imagine this book as a sacred text in addition to a cookbook. It's a collection of psalms.
Hmm. Brent Terry, you open Spirit, this is a really interesting decision, I thought. You open that Spirit prologue with just two recipes, both of them for biscuits. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, I often think about.
You're just like, actually, I just love biscuits. What can I do?
I mean, yeah, that's part of it. But, you know, I think what I was, I'm often thinking about just the ritual of kind of breaking bread and just communion and just kind of in the spirit of what Marvin was just describing, just this, just creating a moment. Just, I think that first bite to me is sacrosanct. And, you know, oftentimes when we sit down, that first bite that we consume is bread. You know, you think about, you go out to a restaurant, they bring you some bread or some kind of carby thing. And so I felt like that was a great way to kind of open up the book and just give some people something. I really, you know, when I think about Black food, I'm often thinking about how I want to help jog people's memory. You know, so much of this book is drawing on history and people's memories. And you know, there's this, it's like this cultural amnesia that I found when I am traveling the country. You know, I sometimes have done up to 90 events in 1 year, speaking engagements. And it's interesting when I go around and I often will start the conversation by asking, well, how many of your family members had, you know, kitchen gardens, and how many of your family members, you know, canned and pickled and preserved and, you know, had agrarian roots? And then people start raising their hands, but it's almost like, oh yeah, I forgot. Nana had that, you know, big cupboard where she had our pickled vegetables. And oh yeah, I forgot we used to eat out of our kitchen garden. And so much of my work is about helping us remember, piece back these histories that I think we often, and memories that we often forget in, you know, this capitalist society that just keeps us busy and working towards these often unattainable goals.
Minister Marvin, one more question before we let you go. What do you hope people take away from this book?
Yeah, it's the same with what I hope people take away when I preach, that they say to themselves, oh hell, I could have wrote that. You know, like it's the connection.
You're a better person than I am. That's not what I hope people think when I write something.
I want it democratized. I want folks to know that this belongs to them. I want them to know that when they can't go get a book, that there is a recipe in them, you know, and they just have to connect to like the larger move of Black culinary spirit and know that it's in there. I love that we collected it here, that Brian collected it here, but I want folks to know that this is what's in them.
Can I just piggyback on that? I just want to say, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Marvin, because that is what I am preaching when I'm out speaking about food issues. And, you know, maybe I'll run myself out of business, but I always say, you know, cookbooks are a guide. I understand that a lot of people, because of the way our lives are structured, people aren't cooking as much. And part of my goal is as an educator and raising people's food IQ and empowering them to, you know, have the fundamental skills of cooking. But ultimately what I tell people is, you know, the magic of cooking is about spontaneity, creativity, using what's on hand, just really drawing from within and you know, kind of bringing out those grandmother measuring energies and just like making something out of nothing. And so, you know, that's really what it's about, is drawing, finding the Black food compendium within ourselves.
Minister Marvin, we're going to let you go. Reverend Marvin K. White, poet, teacher, writer, artist, minister of celebration at Glide Memorial Church. And he contributed the opening prayer poem From Scratch, which he read a piece from here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all.
Brian, I want to ask you about the motherland section. But first, I'm going to get some calls. I want to ask folks, what does Black food mean to you? Is there a family tradition or recipe that makes you feel especially grounded and rooted in your Blackness? We're having a little bit of trouble with the phone, so share your reflections with us. Twitter and Facebook, we're at KQED Forum, or you can email those comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. And looks like the phones may have just opened, so you can give us a call too. 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I wanted to ask you about these pretty fascinating essay, Motherland, by Freda Moyambo. It's kind of a fascinating way to both sort of honor and dissect ideas about Africa with the specificity of this particular story, kind of countering a lot of those colonial abstractions. Can you tell us about, there's a lot of stories like that in this book, and I just want you to talk a little bit about them.
Can I tell you about one of my favorite stories in the book?
Yeah.
Well, but before I do that, because you mentioned something that I feel like I'd like to address. And it's just like, what is Black food for me? And what, you know, in kind of crafting this book, what's the kind of expansive way in which I'm encouraging us to think about Black food? And that term, so I think about, when I think about Black food, I understand that for a lot of people, when they hear the term soul food or when they employ the term soul food, what in their minds, that's synonymous with Black food, right? Black food, soul food. And that whole, that term soul food has always fascinated me, because if you ask a dozen people what it means, you likely get a dozen different answers. And in many ways, I'm not interested in concretizing that term because it's so expansive. And I actually want to challenge us to sit with the expansiveness of that term, because I think it's often been used in a reductive way when it comes to different parts of Black culture, particularly food, soul, right? I think most of us are aware that in the 1960s, during the Black Power movement, that word started to signify this kind of cultural belief in Black resilience in the face of white supremacy. And then, you know, in an effort to celebrate our cultural foods and inventiveness of Black people in the face of oppression, the term soul food came to represent African-American cuisine in the popular imagination. But what I found is when people say, like, Black food, they're thinking about one of two things, is what I found. The kind of antebellum survival foods upon which many African Americans, enslaved Africans, had to rely. And, you know, the problem with even like equating Black food with that, and it's so often very negative. It's like vilifying, because what people say is that's slave food. Like, why would I want to eat, you know, that Black food, soul food? That's just slave food. That's something that we need to kind of leave behind. And it, one, just, It kind of flattens the institution of slavery and doesn't recognize, you know, the institution of slavery wasn't a monolith. Maybe in parts of the Black Belt, it was more of a paternalistic system in which every need of enslaved African material need was provided by plantation owners. But, you know, the institution looked different in the way that the institution of slavery in the coastal Carolinas or the Caribbean and the Louisiana looked. It all looked different. And so just to equate it with soul food is just historically inaccurate and just wrongheaded. But the other thing people are thinking about are the big flavored meats and the overcooked vegetables and the sugary desserts that one might find at a soul food restaurant. And so I'm not denying that either one, like those are both part of this larger, more complex and diverse cuisine. But when we talk about it, so often things like the kind of foods that my grandparents and their parents would grow in their home gardens and urban farms, like, you know, dark leafy greens like collards, mustards, turnips, kale, dandelions, you know, things like sugar snap peas, pole beans, muscadine, grapes, walnuts, these diverse staples that are part of traditional African-American cuisine that I think any Western trained allopathic physician or dietitian or nutritionist would say we should all include in a healthful whole food diet. And I want people to move past the reductive stereotypes and to embrace the diversity of our food and know that, you know, in terms of Black liberation, in terms of like addressing this exponential rise in diet-related health illnesses among Black people, we needn't look any further than our own cultural cuisine. Like, that's where our liberation lies. Like, these are our superfoods. And I really want people throughout the diaspora to know that, you know, the disruptions of colonialism and capitalism that have taken us further away from those traditional foods, I wanted Black food and just all the work that I do to be tools to help us find our way back to those traditions.
We're talking with Brian Terry, chef and food justice activist. He's editor and curator of the new cookbook, Black Food: Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora. What are your questions for Brian Terry? Phones are back up. Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. What's Black food mean to you? 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. We're going to go into the break hearing a bit of the song Bins by Solange Knowles. It's part of the leisure and lifestyle section of Black Food. We'll be back with more. I'm Alexis Madrigal.
I just want to wake up to the sun and say no. $100,000 on the fronts and the blunts. I just want to wake up on guitar.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Try it with your friends. New world water make the tide rise high. Come inland and make your house go by. Fools done upset the old man river. Made him carry slave ships and fed him dead. Now his belly full and he about to flood.
So welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Chef Brian Terry about Black Food, a new cookbook he edited and curated, celebrating food, art, and stories of the African diaspora. That was a bit of Mos Def, he's now known as Yasin Bey, and his prescient song, New World Water, from 1999. It's a part of the Land Liberation and Food Justice section of Black Food. Brian, I want to ask you about the Black Future section. In part, I was really struck by Selassie Adedika's vision for a kind of a new value chain around millet. Just because it seemed like, wow, to kind of center a vision of the future around this like common grain seemed like a very interesting maneuver to me.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this for a while, and I actually have been really uplifting millet as a potential way for us addressing hunger and poverty throughout sub-Saharan Africa, because it's such a, you know, just like hardy grain, nutrient rich. It grows in really rough conditions. And I think that, you know, the work that she's doing is spot on. And we really need to be thinking about ways in which we can, you know, resuscitate and cultivate these ancient grains and superfoods that, you know, have been a part of our diets traditionally as a way to help us, you know, whether it's hunger and poverty and malnutrition or just addressing, you know, food insecurity. Yeah. But I did want to just give you props for, I want to give KQED and you props for playing like parts of the soundtrack, which you can find the Black Food soundtrack on Spotify if people are interested in the playlist. And I don't know, did you know that it was actually a hip hop song that was kind of like the thing that catalyzed my food justice activism?
No, I didn't. But I mean, we got to shout out Ariana Prail, our producer, who chose these selections and paired them up with our conversation. I mean, it's really, she's
thank
so
you,
good.
Ariana. But yeah, when I was in high school, hearing KRS-One, Boogie Down Production, the seminal hip hop group with their lead MC KRS-One, I heard the song Beef from the album Edutainment. And, you know, was kind of convinced, as many of us are, that because of the propaganda of the meat industry, that cows are just kind of running around in the field happily and they just go to sleep and end up on our plates. And so it was shocking to me to learn about the violence of, that our industrial food system, you know, the way in which it violently treats animals and the impact it has on the environment and on human health. And so hearing that song and just being so moved to just change my habits and attitudes and politics regarding food. And then, you know, I asked my dad if he'd buy me the tape, Edutainment, and he said he would. But if I agreed to read this book, The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, and then write him a one-page essay because he's a tiger dad.
we had the same dad. That would be it. It's like, you want to see that movie? Okay, great. You have to read the book. I was like, Dad, it's the autobiography of Malcolm X. It's kind of long.
Right. But yeah, just to say that like those two things, you know, my mantra for like two decades has been start with the visceral to ignite the cerebral and end with the political. Because when I first started, you know, moving into this space around food justice activism and the food movement, when I would go to these national conferences geared towards quote unquote fixing our food system, I was so bothered by the fact that the people who are most impacted by our broken food system, whether it's migrant farm laborers or people living in urban centers that are often described as quote unquote food deserts, like these people weren't in the room. They weren't driving the conversation. And I felt like there were a lot of class and educational assumptions and biases in terms of like the way that the conversations were structured.
And blame, and, you know, it's just people making bad decisions, you know, that kind of thing.
blaming the victim, like the classic not recognizing many of the structural barriers, the physical, the economic, the geographic barriers that people face to accessing healthy food or clean water or, you know, the air that isn't polluted by factories in our neighborhood. So all that to say is that I understood the power of things like art and culture and literature, because those are the things that move me. Those are the things that help me change my habits and attitudes and politics regarding food. And that's why I'm so committed to using multimedia, you know, not just text, not just appealing to like the cerebral, but really moving people on multiple levels. And I think that's one of the powerful ways of expanding the table and inviting the most people into the conversation.
You know, one of the lines that really stuck with me from this book was, I think consuming the foods that our ancestors ate is one of the most powerful ways for us to move toward liberation. And I just thought it might be interesting to hear you reflect on trying to move things to a plant-based world, but also knowing that our ancestors did eat meat, and how to reconcile those things kind of within yourself.
Ooh, you're trying to get me in trouble this morning, Alexis.
Well, now you're warmed up, so I figure now you're ready for it.
Well, it's always been a tricky conversation, because I recognize that, you know, and I'm just going to keep it real. Like, yeah, maybe I don't want to keep it that real. Well, let me just say this. I'm very clear. Well, one of the things that I think is often missing from the criteria of when we talk about like eating healthfully, I think so much emphasis is put on like nutrients and micronutrients. And I think there is something to us eating our ancestral foods. You know, I think about when my wife was pregnant and we had like, you know, when she had our first daughter and we had like these traditional postpartum Chinese recipes that she was consuming for 3 months, because these are things that people, you know, they knew, they had the practice, they had the history, they knew that these were the type of foods that you needed to eat to rebuild the mother's constitution, to ensure that, you know, the milk was nutrient rich and all these things. And so I just think that, you know, our food, it carries our history, it carries our memories. And it's something that like, these are like, we've been turned away from the magic and brilliance of our own foods. You know, I hate the fact that when we talk about superfoods, and I know I've doubled down on superfoods a number of times throughout this conversation, and it's because I want us to reframe the way that we often are convinced to think about these practices. You know, I think about like the fact that when we hear slow food, we automatically default towards like Western Europe and thinking about the brilliant Carlo Petrini and the activism that he started in Italy. But you can't tell me that my grandmother in the kitchen all day Saturday making food for Sunday supper isn't slow food practices and traditions. And you know, I'm happy that we're talking about quinoa and goji berries and acai as these like nutrient dense superfoods, but what about collard greens, which have like, you know, lots of vitamin A and C and anti-cancer you know, compounds, as you know, I'm not saying this as a scientist, but you know, some research studies have found these things. And so I just really want people to reframe Black food and celebrate it for all its brilliance, its nutrient density, and its way to connect us with who we are, and you know, our traditions from the past, and help us think about how can we create traditions in this moment that are going to carry us through, you know, these perilous times that we're in.
So I'm holding this book in my hands, and I'm just feeling the weight of it and the quality of the paper and the beauty of the artwork in it. I want to talk about you doing publishing now, because this is the first book from this imprint, Four Color Books. And I want to know what you're planning on doing with it, because, I mean, this is a really nice start to a new imprint as an artifact, as a book, as a thing in the world.
Thank you. Well, I knew that, you know, this is our flagship publication, so we had to come out hard. We had to like show and prove. And I feel like this is a great way of kind of establishing the way that this imprint shows up in the world. And so let me just say, there's the publishing arm, which we're going to be publishing, you know, a few books per year as we start off, and starting with my wheelhouse, which is cookbooks and food related books. But as we grow, I want to publish everything that I'm interested in, from poetry to, you know, personal development and self-help to prescriptive nonfiction. lifestyle. You know, interestingly, the second book that we acquired is actually an art book that is being created by this Brooklyn-based photographer, Adrian Baril. But yeah, like, I am so excited about helping diversify food media, bringing more people of color, and not just authors. You know, it's one thing to have, like, because I think because of 2020 and, you know, the revelation of racism within a lot of food media and some of the legacy food media companies and some publishing companies were called out. What we'll see over the next couple of years is just a barrage of books by Black talent, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's important to move beyond just the talent. Well, I mean, the people who we see. What about the quote unquote below the line people like food photographers, food stylists, prop stylists, you know, all these people who, I mean, it's a very white field. And I it's because so often it's about, you know, getting, being mentored and shadowing on set. And so I really want us to help create more pipelines into food media and publishing. And I think that the reality is you can give as many book contracts out to people of color as you want, but if we aren't changing the people who are in power, who are making decisions about what contracts will be given and what projects are worthy of elevating and celebrating, then when the door closes, as it inevitably will, then we're just going to be back at square one. And that was one of the reasons that my agent and I, you know, we just had to go for it. And I had to get over all these artificial barriers of when I get this many followers or have sold this many books or whatever I kind of propose would be the thing that would make me ready to start a publishing imprint. I just had to like let that go and push through my fear. And I'm really excited about the work that, I mean, we the first book we acquired was Rahana Bizarred Martinez, the brilliant Oakland-based Afro-Latinx chef, 17 years old. She was a finalist on Top Chef Junior when she was 13. She's cooked, stodged at some of the finest restaurants around the world, from Chez Panisse to Ecoy in London. She cooked at the James Beard House. And so we're going to be publishing her book, Adrian Baril's art book. We are publishing it's a pizza manifesto from the Afro-Dominican chef Scar Pimentel. Scar's Pizzeria in Lower East Side is one of the highly celebrated pizza shops in New York City now. So I'm excited about the books, but I just want to finish by saying that there's the action arm as well. So we're in the midst of planning a Black Food Summit that'll be happening in April at the Museum of the African Diaspora, where we'll be bringing together a lot of the contributors to the book and others to just build community and to share skills and to, you know, just like be with each other and eat and celebrate. We're amassing databases so that there isn't the excuse, well, we couldn't find a person of color to shoot the book or to do the food styling or do the prop styling, like, or be the art director. Like, we want to have these resources so that people can actually, you know, put their money where their mouth is and do the work of bringing more brilliant BIPOC folks into this field.
Well, I wanted to give you a chance to shout out some of the people who worked on your book, like Portia Burke, right? She helped get a new edition of Toni Morrison's The Black Book out there in the world. And then she also worked on this book. Who are some of those other folks who, as you said, below the line, you know, people who are really important for the production of something like this?
Yeah, big up to my publisher, 10 Speed Press, for really just being so open to the collaborative process of this and moving beyond the people in-house. And we were able to bring in Portia Burke, who's a longtime editor at Penguin Random House. As you said, she helped with the republishing of Toni Morrison's Black Book, as well as the autobiography of Malcolm X. She was Maya Angelou's editor. Jenny Wapner, one of the most brilliant publishers or editors/publishers in food media. You know, she just happened to be between jobs. She was a project manager on Black Food. This book could not have happened without Jenny's brilliance and publishing expertise. George McCowman, our art director, that, you know, Betsy Stromberg, who's the art director at 10 Speed, was so generous in allowing him to come in and take charge of this project. Because I made it clear that for a book like this, we needed not just a Black art director, but a Black art director who understands Black visual language and aesthetics and history and could connect with this work spiritually. And that's what we got with George. And he brilliantly designed the book and this award-winning cover, you know, and the charge that I gave George, I was like, I want a cover that departs from what most people imagine when they see cookbooks. And I want one that speaks to both Black people and food, with having neither Black people nor food on the cover.
And he's like, oh boy, this is going to be a long week.
But he killed it. And yeah, and so, you know, our photographer, Oriana Corin, our prop stylist, Jillian Kang, our food stylist, Lillian Kang, and their assistants, and Amanda Yee, my creative director, who's living in Berlin. And so I just want to shout out all those people, because this is not my book. I am a good leader. I'm a good team builder. And I built a brilliant team that helped execute this vision that I had. And I think that that's the ethos of For Color. We want to do things that bring in community, that is collaborative, and that really pushes this movement and just the field of cookbook writing and food writing forward.
So you've said that this is your last cookbook. Do you think that's really true? You don't think that in like a few years you're going to say like, you know, I think I have this new itch, these new recipes that I want to get in front of people?
You know, this is it for me. I always said I wanted to quote unquote go out when I'm on top, and having such a stellar year with...
Dude, you're like 40. Come on.
But you know the real thing, Alexis, I want to take this next period to really focus on being a good publisher. I don't know. I mean, I know about publishing because I've been in food media, but I'm in a period where I'm awkward, I'm goofy. I started doing CrossFit like 4 months ago, and and I love it. I'm not like a cultish person, but I love CrossFit. But I feel like it's interesting that I'm doing CrossFit as I'm starting this publishing company, because I'm awkward. I'm figuring stuff out. I'm a little goofy. I need a lot of support and help. And I like being in that place. And I really want to be able to focus all my energy on being a good publisher, because I think one of the most powerful things that For Color will do is modeling. I want us to model a different way that publishing books can look like. And so I want to give all my energy to it. And I feel like I've had a stellar career as an author, and it's time to hang up the cleats.
So really quickly, last minute here, someone picks up the book. What's a recipe they should just turn to and go like, all right, this is my entry point. I'm going to start here.
Woo!
Look, not your favorite, but just a starting point.
Just a starting point. The Sweet Potato Snack by the brilliant Dr. Howard Conyers, who's literally a rocket scientist for NASA. And he's also been, resuscitating these whole hawk cooking traditions in his family. And he comes from a family of sweet potato farmers. And I like the recipe that he has in there. It's such a simple recipe. It's just grilling sweet potatoes. I think you can add some butter or olive oil on it. And I love the simplicity of that. I love the image of that. It's one of my favorite images in the book. But when I think about like just the beauty of local, seasonal, sustainable food, you know, always we could talk about the politics. You could talk about the environmental and economic reasons to eat in this way that we promote. But I know people are self-interested. And one of the things I often say is that when you get food that's locally grown, that's in season, that's been harvested like very recently, it's going to be so much more flavorful than something that's been sitting on refrigerator trucks coming from California for, you know, a couple weeks and then sitting in a refrigerator. And that's what a good entry point. So when you have that, something like a sweet potato that's fresh, all you need to do is simply prepare it. And it's just going to be brilliant and delicious.
Yeah. One comment before we go. Hillary writes, thank you for this conversation. I'm excited to purchase this book. And I want to emphasize your guest point about superfoods. So many amazingly nutritious and delicious foods grow right here. Don't require exploitation of other economies. We've been talking with Brian Terry, chef and food justice activist. New books, Black Food, Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora. Thank you so much, Brian, for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Alexis. This has been a pleasure.
Earlier, we were joined by Reverend Marvin K. White, and we're going to close things out with K. Trinata and his song Do It, which is part of Black Queer Food section of Black Food. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.